In 2003, Nike signed 13-year-old Freddie Adu to a 7-figure contract. But Freddie didn't live up to the hype. He has turned down every single documentary project looking closely at the details of his career. Until now.
People are going to look at everything you did because of the hype surrounding your arrival and what they think you can be.
I'm Grant Wall, and this is American Prodigy, Freddie Adu, from Blue Wire Podcasts.
Hello?
We're on to Cincinnati.
You play to win the game.
It was all that Dan Marino's fault. Everyone knows that.
When it's too tough for them, it's just right for us.
Rockpile Report, AFC East Roundup, hosted by Bills season ticket holder Drew Gear, a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network.
Yeah, my thoughts were whatever was going to be best for the team. You know, we couldn't really get things going. And, you know, Coach felt like it was the best decision to put Fitz in to try to give us a spark. So when I heard that, I mean, you know, it's really what's best for the team. I mean, if we were to win with Fitz in there, you know, the locker room would be a lot different. Everyone would be a lot happier. But, you know, it just sucks to lose. Well, I think you look at the entirety of the game and you learn from a lot of what the defense, you know, that the Broncos had shown. I mean, they played a lot of base to our normal, you know, our normal offense. You know, we try to get them out of their base look, and you know what we were doing, we just couldn't execute. And you know, for me, it was a great learning experience. You know, and I felt like I was holding the ball a little too long. Just got to get completions, and you know, got to get the ball in the hands of our guys to make plays for us.
Welcome, everybody, to the AFC East Roundup Podcast. I'm your host, Bills season ticket holder Drew Gear. That's my producer, Chris Krueger, us of the Rockpile Report podcast. And that was Tua Tagovailoa discussing his benching against Denver in his press conference over at Dolphins.com. Week 11 action in the AFC East. Chris, it couldn't have gone better for the Buffalo Bills.
Nope. I believe the Dolphins lost, the Patriots lost, and Chris, we already know about the Jets.
The Bills, 7-3, sitting in first place still, with the whole division losing on a day when the Bills sat at home and rested. I mean, I'll let Larry David say it.
Pretty good.
They still maintain their 1.5 game and lead in the AFC, or at least AFC East, on a day when everyone else lost. We got a toast to that. Put it up.
Cheers.
The Dolphins at 6-4 in second place. Tua to the bench. Tua to the bench. That's I felt like I was watching like Office Space.
Yeah.
In Tua's worst showing as a professional, and despite a late rally, the Dolphins fall to the Broncos, who surprisingly are just one win against Buffalo away from sweeping the AFC East. That's a little wild, isn't it?
Yeah.
They're not a good football team. But
They're average.
But they've beaten everybody else in our division.
Yeah.
The Patriots are 4-6 sitting in third place with a resounding loss to what has been a dreadful Texans team that was missing its left tackle, left guard, and two of its starting wide receivers. The Patriots have reached what must feel like, for most of their fans, a low point in this season.
How often does Belichick lose to one of his disciples?
It never. I didn't think about
like,
that.
Chris, is it like Saban with his disciples?
When we were talking about it this past week, I was like, oh, they build this game as like student versus master. Bill O'Brien versus...
Well, not Bill O'Brien, Romeo Crennel.
No, but I forgot that, well, at the time it was Bill O'Brien when they scheduled it. And yes. I'm sure they thought it would have some juice. And instead, you got Romeo Crennel, the most unsexy Belichick protege. And yet, he's the one who gets a win? Not Bill O'Brien, but Romeo Crennel. Ugh, God. They're now 11th in the AFC, which is foreign territory for Patriots fans and their curmudgeon of a head coach. And the Jets, 0-10, fourth place. I have officially run out of ways to articulate the state of this team, so I've decided that from here on out, for the rest of the season, I'm going to let Will Ferrell do it for me.
Skyrockets in flight. Afternoon delight. And I make fart noises with my mouth. And I like to cut.
Hey, nutjob! Quit the singing! Creeping out all the regulars.
I'm expressing my inner anguish to the majesty of song!
I think that sums up the feeling of Jets Nation right about now, doesn't it?
Pretty much.
Here we go. The only place to start, the biggest story, I mean, with the Bills on the bye, the biggest story in the AFC East this week was the Miami Dolphins, who lost 20-13 to the Denver Broncos. Here to talk to us about everything that's gone on this week is Mr. Elf Arteaga. How are you feeling today, sir?
Exhausted.
It's been a long couple days, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what's with this fan base, but every time they lose, Jesus Christ, man.
See, I'm glad that you
can... wouldn't think that we won like 5,000 Super Bowls down here. By the way, these people act. These bunch of maniacs, every time they lose, no matter how they lose, too. You know what I mean?
And it doesn't matter to who.
Yeah, it doesn't matter to who. I remember when we lost to the Bills, it was an entire week of, okay, they just threw away all this money. Byron Jones gets injured in the first play of the game, biggest game of the year, so he's worthless. Emmanuel Ogba's terrible. They got to get rid of Shaq Lawson, see if what they could get for him at the trade deadline. All these were things that they were telling us during that week.
Oh, my God.
3 weeks later, they want to put all these guys in Canton. You know what I mean?
I feel like what you're describing... See, now this is the best part about this, and this is what I love about this podcast, is that we get to watch people experience things, shifts. Mm-hmm. Chris, how many times have you watched me be the way he's describing about our Buffalo Bills?
Every single Sunday, win or lose. It could be a shutout.
It could be a shutout. I'm going to find somebody to be mad at.
Yes, mostly Brian Daboll.
Mostly because I'm just, it's my energy. I'm never content. And so it feels like your fan base might be the same way. The Miami Dolphins went out and they lost 20-13 to the Denver Broncos. And obviously...
Oh, in that same vein, by the way, the week that the Dolphins shut out the Jets, 24-0,
mm-hmm.
The first 2 days after that day, every single tweet to our Twitter account, every phone call on talk radio was all the same. The offense looks stale, looks terrible. 2 days later, they named two of the starter, and everybody's like, what the hell are they doing naming two of the starter?
It's like, wait a minute, you were angry about this. The team listened to you. They did the thing that you wanted, and now you're mad about it. Which is further proof that human beings are flawed and we should all just be flung into the sun. But until that happens, we're stuck here on Earth dealing with each other. Insanity, thy name, is the 2020 Dolphins season. I feel like you guys, more so, the Buffalo Bills, great, we've had a run here. This is one of the better seasons that I, as a fan, have seen in decades. You guys have had the craziest season of any team in the AFC East. Is that fair to say?
I would say so, yeah, because everybody else is it's been pretty, I would say, predictable. Like, we all thought the Jets were going to be terrible. None of us thought that the Patriots were going to be any good.
None of us, because we're... Because we're intelligent people who actually look at data, who look at the... We don't work for ESPN. We're not these people, these lunatics.
All of us figured the Patriots for being what they are right now, which is a middling team, 7-9, 6-10, 8-8-ish.
Not one of these lunatics working for some pundit working for an outlet that says, well, Wrap it up. Slap your hands together. They got Cam Newton. Clearly, they're dark horses for the Super Bowl. Whoever said that, I feel like you should be... If you can't fire those people, like, if that's not grounds to get fired from mainstream media, I feel like that's at least your boss should go to your cubicle or your office and turn everything over. Just knock everything on the floor. Because you put that into print and clearly you don't know what the hell you're talking about. But the Miami Dolphins were, they had the most potential, but also the lowest floor. Because they were a lot of unknowns, a lot of young players, a lot of question marks. Mm-hmm. You started low, started 0-2, and then took off. And then you swapped quarterbacks. And then you swapped quarterbacks back! I mean, the benching of Tua Tagovailoa is the story of the week. It's, you guys have experienced it all, and it's incredible to sit here knowing, Chris, isn't this the perfect season to have a podcast like this?
Yeah, it is. It seems everything's falling apart around our division.
No, but it's just like there's stories. There's things that are incredible to talk about. Like the Tua Tagovailoa situation. I liked him through three games in the sense that he doesn't take a lot of contact. Which is, he showed some smarts about it. Like, when you think about young quarterbacks who have failed to do that, I think of guys like Jake Locker. I think of guys like Carson Wentz, RG3, early Josh Allen, Drew Locke. Drew Locke right now, still, to this day, in that game, I could watch him really not have a whole lot of idea of how to protect himself, even though he's playing with bad ribs. That's how we got him in the first place. So then to watch how that game unfolded, how painful was that to see?
Well, he was just not processing like he had been processing before. He was taking unnecessary sacks. And first of all, the rush was getting in there. And it seemed to all be triggered from one thing. Solomon Kinley got injured, and they shuffled around the offensive line. But they shuffled it around enough to the point where it was, at one point, kind of successful. Because this happened before. Kinley had left the game before with an injury, and they had put Jesse Davis out there and Robert Hunt at right tackle. This time they did that, and it was just the floodgates. The floodgates just opened up. Maybe their game plan wasn't ready to have those guys in there, but he was just holding on to the ball way too long. This was something he had not done in his little winning streak. So,
well, and that's what he talked about, like the clip we played in the intro to the show. He even admitted, I was holding the ball too long. What was, now I know you do the yard work series over there for 3 yards per carry and 5 reasons sports. What did you see in breaking down the film from that game that caused him to hold on to the ball like that? Because he hadn't done it to this point in his career.
Well, he was just hesitant, and he was hesitating to pull the trigger on things that he was seeing. And I don't know if he was expecting guys to be much more open, because he even admitted it that Ryan Fitzpatrick had told him on the bench, look, you know, in the NFL, you know, some guys are not as open as other guys. And what might look covered to you is actually open in the NFL. And you just got to throw it. And he was saying, look, now I understand that Devontae Parker, if he's even with somebody, he's wide open. Okay? Because he's going to make a play on somebody. Because he could jump over you. He could shield you off. He's a big body receiver. So he can make a play. But he also missed wide open people. And it was on like the first 4 or 5 plays of the game where the plays where he missed wide open people. Namely, Devontae Parker on a flag route that could have gone for a touchdown if not for 40 yards. And Jakeem Grant on a go route where he was completely open. 5 yards past the cornerback, and Tua Tagovailoa overthrew him.
Well, and to your point, though, like so he was in his own head, it almost seemed like. Because yes. I watched that game, and I was messaging you during the game, which I don't know if you check your DMs mid-game, but I'm messaging him going, man, first of all, I think my first message was, fuck Adam Gase for not letting Devontae Parker just be a football player. How dare he ruin this? He's a good wide receiver. But then as the game went on, I'm like, what's happening here? Your offensive line didn't do him any favors. I mean, according to Pro Football Focus, Jackson had the left tackle that you guys have kind of, especially now with an injury to Solomon Kinley. Solomon Kinley is arguably the surprise of the year on the offensive line for the Dolphins. But Austin Jackson being better than he was billed to be coming out of the draft was definitely a boon for you guys in the early parts of the season. He gave up 9 quarterback pressures and 49 blocking opportunities, 2 sacks and 7 hurries. What did they do to him that just made that his day so hard?
Well, first of all, there's dispute on that because there's certain people, and I've gone over the All-22. I can't find the 9 pressures. And I think what they're doing is that they're calling line slides where you allow the farthest man to be the free rusher. I think they're calling those pressures.
Okay. That's
but
fair.
But even then, he was bad because he did give up 2 sacks and he gave up, I would say 4 pressures is what some guy counted it at. I could find 5. I could see 5. I don't see 9. But it was really the stunts and twists that they were running on him. And ever since he came back from his injury, he's been a little bit slow on, I guess, the uptake of what they're trying to do to him. Because they were doing all of this before he got injured. He was picking it up. Now he's having a little bit harder time. But it was a combination of everything. It was those stunts, those twists, and all the blitzes that they were sending on his side that he was having problems picking them up. It was mostly mental. And physically, it was just he wasn't sliding as well as he had before. And which is odd because he was coming off his best game as a pro the week before against the Chargers, where he had Melvin Ingram one-on-one the entire game and allowed nothing, not even a pressure.
I mean, one of the craziest parts of the game to me was just how ineffective the offense was after weeks of being quietly efficient. Denver had 189 rushing yards to 56. Yes. From Miami. Miami got most of those in the early part of the game. Because mm-hmm. I remember I was going to DM you, can I run behind this offensive line? Like, who can't run the ball for the Dolphins? But that was the first couple drives, and then that dried up and disappeared. They gave up 6 sacks, and then I think one of the more damning things was the penalties. Your team was only penalized 5 times, but as I'm watching the game, every one of them came in a critical moment. It was like, absolutely. Oh, here's a 3rd down play where it looks like you might be in range. Yeah, okay, we're 3rd and 6, false start. And you go, oh, shit. Now it's 3rd and 11, knowing that this is a beleaguered offensive line that's hemorrhaging pressure. Now you just backed yourselves up into obvious passing territory. You can't even keep those guys honest. First of all, how apoplectic was? Sounds like Dolphins Twitter was on fire, right?
Yes. Okay. No, they lost their minds during that game. It was fun to watch, amusing and tragic, all in the same. Well, in the same breath.
And that's it. And usually I'm one of those people. I've just learned to stay off social media this year. This is the first season where I'm not angrily tweeting from it. Do you know that we're benched by Richie Incognito? We're blocked on Twitter by Richie Incognito.
Really?
Yeah, because apparently that lunatic, thinks that I'm too much. That lunatic thinks that apparently my takes on his play are a little too much. Ooh, I hurt his feelings. So I've learned to stay off social media on game days, except for the purposes of DMing and doing a little of this and that.
Well, I do the same. I don't go on. I don't go on the Twitter account on game days.
So
only to like I post a GIF or GIF, whatever, however you pronounce it. I'll put a GIF out there and that's it, and then I'll leave. So, but I don't want no part whatsoever of the Twitter account.
So okay. as we're watching this unfold, you're seeing the offense struggle. They're shooting themselves in the foot left and right. Obviously, I'm sure Dolphins fans out there they're not happy. They're angry. They're angry about a lot of things. But the big thing was watching, and the wild thing about this game was the benching of Tua. Okay, he takes his 6th sack. They draw him out of the game, and they put in Ryan, cool enough to date your mom or your sister, Fitzpatrick. I mean, that guy, he comes in and just calmly leads you guys on a field goal drive. Yeah. Did that give you any kind of hope for the outcome?
Yeah, I thought he had a shot, but then I remembered, okay, it is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and I mentioned Ben Volin of Patriots fame and former Dolphins fame. He used to cover the Dolphins down here. He had come out and said, okay, is everybody now ready to be on my side? The answer is no, of course. He was saying that Ryan Fitzpatrick was the better quarterback for now for the Miami Dolphins. And he goes, the evidence is right there. And everybody was telling him, Ben, you do understand that, like, late in games, it's entirely possible that the backup quarterback could come in and will find favorable coverages and bring him in. And then I said, yeah, Ben, he really put himself in the perfect position to throw the most back-breaking interception possible into the end zone when you're trying to tie the game. And that's exactly what he did.
Oh, no.
Exactly what he did. And I don't know if you saw the drive. I don't know if you saw the condensed.
Oh, I saw it. I saw it all. I took it all in. And
we
I said
got
to myself,
the ball back. Okay, this could have been the most epic comeback in the history of Ryan Fitzpatrick's career. We get the ball back at our own one-yard line with 4 minutes left. Our own one-yard line. And he drives the length of the field like if there's no defense against him. And, of course, he gets down there at the 14-yard line. And what does he do? Throws it right into double coverage, intercepted, game over.
So the Buffalo Bills once played a game against the New England Patriots where the Bills were penalized for one whole football field's worth of penalties. Ryan Fitzpatrick somehow brought us back, marched down the field with time expiring, and on the final play of the game, threw a pick in the end zone. And it was one of the most crushing. My friends, after that game, I drank a gallon of homemade wine during that game. And my friends told me, Drew, we watched you over the course of 3 hours experience every human emotion. And then I just went and fell asleep on the couch. Like that was, and you guys just got your taste of the Ryan Fitzpatrick experience because that's what it is. He'll tease you and then he kicks the chair out from underneath you. Now, for as much as we want to point to the benching and the apoplectic nature of fans, the defensive effort wasn't great either. Your rush defense was horribly porous. I mean, kudos to Van Ginkle for making a timely play and punching out a ball that should have been a rushing touchdown at the goal line. But that rushing attack is what allowed Denver to keep itself in the game because their passing attack, Drew Lock, is nothing special.
No.
What were they doing to frustrate your – I mean, because your run defense had been pretty good to that point.
Yeah, what they were doing is that they were exacerbating a problem that we have, and that's that if you put three wide receivers on the field, we insist on putting more defensive backs out there. And then they got us into a guessing game with – and Brian Flores happened to win a couple of those guesses. I don't know if you saw there was a play that they went for it on fourth and one, and we stopped them. On fourth and one to get the ball back, although it didn't do us much good because we didn't score when we got the ball back. But they went for it on fourth and one in our territory. And it's just a Brian Flores started trying to play a guessing game with their offense. And they really did do a great job having us completely off balance and running with out of those wide sets with the three wide receivers against our nickelbacks. And they got on the edge on us. And they kept running that outside zone, outside zone, outside zone. They would hit one, two, three blocks. And then those two running backs are really good. Melvin Gordon and Philip Lindsay, those two guys are really, really, really good.
No, they're no slouches. I mean, that's one of the reasons that people thought Denver was going to be better than they were this year.
Yeah, I
mean,
I thought so too. You know, when the season's going to start and you say, okay, this is a win and this is a loss and this is a win and this is a loss, this is one of those games where I had penciled in a loss because I expected them to be much better than what they are right now.
So looking ahead, does this game... Does it help or hurt your confidence in what is ultimately a very tough slate ahead for the Miami Dolphins? I mean, your offense only managed 2.7 yards per play in the first half. You got to watch it, but then fans everywhere who were saying, oh, Tua sucks, Tua's this, Tua's that. They got to watch Fitzmagic turn into Fitztragic in the span of 10 minutes. There's no quarterback controversy, according to your head coach. I don't know if that makes fans feel any better. What is the where are you guys as a fan base entering what is going to be a pretty tough finish to the season?
Well, they're in the same place that they were really a week ago. They know what's in front of them. They got the Jets this week, and they got the Bengals the following week. Okay?
Yeah.
That should get you to 8-4. Then you got your tough stretch of four games that you have to split. You split them, you got 10 wins. That should get you in the playoffs. That's what they're expecting. Those are the expectations. But the short-term expectations is to get this offense back on track. And I believe that Myles Gaskin is going to come back soon, if not this week, the following week. So that should give them some help. And they are expecting Preston Williams back inside of 3 weeks. So that gives them another weapon. So they need to fix something on offense. I don't know what they're going to do. They have enough as far as brain power to try to gimmick up some type of offense for the next few weeks. I think their defense is good enough, and it's going to be getting healthier also, because these last two games, it's been noticeable not having Christian Wilkins. It's hurt the run defense. Not having Christian Wilkins has really hurt the run defense. The week before with Kellen Ballage and company, and this week with those two backs. So he comes back this week, so help is on the way. But the expectations haven't changed. It's 10 wins.
If there's one thing I could say, and I want you to tell your Dolphins listeners, here's something that I want to bring to you. Bills fans watched you guys, how the Dolphins handled this situation. And there's a lot of people who drew corollaries between, because there's a lot of second guessing of Flores going on right now, which is stupid to me. But you see people in the Bills fan base saying things like, trying to draw corollaries to Tua's game on Sunday and Josh Allen's game back in 2018? Game three against the Green Bay Packers. He went out and had an atrocious.
He laid the definition of an egg.
He would have gotten negative fantasy points. That's how bad of a day it was. Interceptions, no points, really nothing productive accomplished. He took a beating out there. And McDermott didn't bench him. And so you heard a lot of Bills fans talking about how, well, you know, our coach would never do that. And bah, 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 bah. And that's not how you develop a quarterback. Bah, 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 bah. First of all, you can't compare the two. The situations are very different. The Bills made the playoffs in 2017. Inexplicably. No one expected us to make the playoffs, but they did. And that satisfied the fan base. Okay? So now you're talking about a coach with a little cachet. You're also going into 18 knowing that our roster, Chris, we spent $12 million on the whole offensive line. I think we talked about it that whole season, that our whole line was making less than Taylor Lewan. That's it. Our whole line made less than him. So everyone had an expectation that this team was going to be bad. So it's easy to leave a quarterback who's struggling out there when you know that your expectation for the team that year is low. You know you're not going to win, and you don't have to win. There's no pressure. When I put myself into Flores' shoes, I'm looking at a football team that started this season not expecting to be in a playoff race. But now they're here. Not just in a playoff race, but potentially in a race for the division. And if that's the case, he's learned from his years being around the Patriots organization how important that division win is. Not only that, but he's got a roster full of veteran players who he has to keep bought in. You know how you lose that locker room? Is you tell them, listen, we're willing to burn a game of your career, maybe two, maybe three, by not trying to win games, by not trying to make the best decision for our football team here in the moment every single week. So with that said, Flores, I think, is still trying to prove himself with a young and talented roster, and he couldn't afford to let Tua's bad day and the offensive line's bad day derail the momentum that this team had. Would you agree with me on that?
Yeah, there was a certain staleness to that team going into that fourth quarter. Like, they were just running out the clock. Like, it was 20-10, and they were just running out the clock to just get out of there with that 10-point loss. And you could tell the staleness had probably gotten to Brian Flores, and he decided, you know what, I'm gonna try to goose this up a little bit, and I'm gonna bring in Ryan Fitzpatrick, and we're gonna go up tempo. And he said it on the sideline. He went up to him and he told him, look, we're gonna go up tempo and we're gonna throw it a lot, and you know, we're gonna try to win this game here. And Tua said, okay, I guess I'm going to the bench. And then Ryan Fitzpatrick came in, and that's exactly what he did. He came in, they went up tempo, and he threw it a lot. Because he actually had almost as many attempts in the fourth quarter as Tua had the entire game.
And that's exactly it. And I guess that's the takeaway from this. If you're a Bills fan listening to this show, wondering what the hell happened out there in Denver, or you want to point fingers or try to draw corollaries, they're not the same. They're not the same by a country mile. And ultimately, Brian Flores should maybe be applauded for doing what he has to do to keep the attention of his football team by saying, look, Every game matters. Every game from here to the end of the season matters because we're suddenly in this playoff race. And I'll be no one is bigger than the team. Not our rookie quarterback, who we love, who he said, there's no quarterback controversy. Fitzpatrick said it himself. There's no quarterback controversy. This is to his team. But in that moment, the coach had the guts to pull the trigger and say, look, I have to do what I think might win us this game. And it almost worked. Doesn't that make you feel good about your head coach?
I would say so. And he doesn't sugarcoat anything. Everybody watches him and says, okay, this is a guy that never smiles and he's always really, really serious. But if you watch him on the sidelines, you know, he's hugging it up with the guys that he thinks are his guys. And I really liked his post-game press conference and his day after press conference, he singled out the guys that were, you could tell were battling. Andrew Van Ginkel had the most disastrous penalty and play that you could have had at that moment. When you have him stopped and he commits a personal foul to put him down near the goal line. And what does he do the very next play?
Fumble.
He forces a fumble. So he brought that out on him. And Devontae Parker, who in my opinion was the only guy that played on offense, which was, you know, it was funny to watch him try to carry an entire offense as a wide receiver, but there he was. So I like that about Brian Flores, and I think they'll get it together. You know, you can't ask for a better opponent this week. And we have our buddy Sam Darnold coming back, so that should be fun.
Well, you guys enjoy that. Why don't you tell our listeners what you have coming up this week, where they can find you on social, what you have coming up on Yard Work.
Of course, it's 3 yards per carry. That's at 3 yards per carry on Twitter. You can find us on the Five Reasons Sports Network YouTube account. The Yard Work series is on there. And of course, you can get our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. iTunes, Spotify, everything.
2020 has already reshaped how we work, and it's almost over. Businesses across the globe are challenged to be their most efficient, which means every hire is critical. Indeed is here to help. Indeed is the number one job site in the world with more total visits than any other job site. Indeed helps you find quality candidates quickly so you can focus on hiring the person you need to keep your business going. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You only pay for what you need, you can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. And now, Indeed's new way of matching you with candidates instantly delivers a short list of quality candidates whose resume on Indeed match your job criteria that you can contact the moment you sponsor a job, making Indeed the only job site that can move as fast as you do. 73% of online job seekers in the U.S. are visiting Indeed each month. So it's clear Indeed can help you get the quality hire you need. That's why more than 3 million businesses worldwide use Indeed for hiring. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/BlueWire. This is their best offer available anywhere. Go right now to Indeed.com/BlueWire. Offer valid through December 31st. Terms and conditions apply.
I gotta say, Chris, it takes a lot of balls for Elf to volunteer to come on this show after a game like that. I love it.
Well, I mean, he said it himself, you know, in the preseason. He had this Denver game chalked up as a loss.
It was interesting because we got to sit on the couch. Yeah. Buffalo Bills players were sitting at home, wrapped in bubble wrap, while all of this was going on. And one of the things, now, you heard me allude to it a little bit. I sat at home and watched it. If you follow us on Twitter over at Rockpile Report, I sat at home, Chris, with 3 TVs. I don't know about you. You watch no football?
No, I think I stuck more to the Philadelphia-Cleveland game.
Why? This is what I don't... Chris, this is why I know you're a bad person. Like, this is how I know that you... No one should subject themselves to that.
So if you were... Let me ask you this. So if you're driving down the 90 and then you see a car change lanes and just clip the bumper of another car and then flip four times. You're not going to just...
I'm going to stick around for that.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly my point. Why watch Cleveland and Philadelphia? You kidding me?
Up top, that's pretty good. So,
plus your boy Mark Schlereth was on the call. So,
God, Mark Schlereth, I'll never forgive him for saying Buffalo had no quarterbacks between Tyrod Taylor, Matt Cassel, and Nathan Peterman. I'll never forgive him for that. With that in mind, I watched Sunday football in my man cave of a basement. Chris, it's set up for entertaining.
Barely.
What do you mean barely? Chris, we have tables, we have chairs, we have a sectional couch with a nice area for children to play. We've got the place is set up, multiple bathrooms.
Yeah, if you'd like
to. It's not as good as the wet bar was. I'll give it that.
No, I just go sit on the couch and collect yourself in dog hair.
Listen, I have dogs. I don't know what you want from me. I vacuum that couch every day, and it doesn't make a difference. They're shepherds. They'll shit all over everything. But either way, I know your fancy wardrobe. Oh, little dog hair.
Yeah. I don't want any...
With your cardigan sweater.
Yeah, I don't want any dog hair on this cardigan.
I have double wall-mounted flat screens, 55 inches apiece. And then I have my tablet, and I have that up, and I have the Sunday ticket, and I have a fridge full of beer next to me, and I get to live my best life on Bills bye weeks. Because I get to sit down and with no pressure watch football happen all over the NFL. And it's great! Multiple games. This isn't like the red zone, where you're beholden to some pie-in-the-sky entity that shows you what they think is cool. I want to watch the football I want to see. So as I'm looking around the AFC and I'm watching all these games play out, one of the things I walked away with is, Chris, teams got massacred with injuries this week.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, the Bills are a team slowly working their way back to health. Milano, he's, what, 1 week away from the team having to make a decision as to whether or not to activate him off IR?
Yep.
The linebacking core is finally getting healthy from a depth perspective with Dodson working his way back. Our offensive line is finally getting all of its envisioned starters healthy for the first time all season. Our defensive line's getting healthier as AJ Epenesa works his way back from a concussion and Vernon Butler, his ankle's getting better. They finally have their top three cornerbacks healthy at the same time for the first time since training camp. And depth piece Dane Jackson is working back from his tweak that pulled him out of that loss to Arizona. That was a blow.
Yeah, it was.
Jackson was playing his ass off.
Yeah.
In a sport that's defined by its vast amount of physical attrition, the Bills are actually getting to be the healthiest version of themselves that they've been all year. There's still some concerns. Obviously, John Brown, his knee.
Yep.
The COVID situation, which just took Tom Sweeney out.
But he hasn't played all year, so.
No, but think about that. It ended his season. Now think about these other guys who have come into the COVID circle. Are there long-term concerns there? Maybe. We don't know. We don't know. But ultimately, this Bills team is getting healthier, and that timing couldn't be better considering we're in the home stretch of the 2020 season. Like I said, watching Sunday's action, we were lucky our guys were on the couch because injuries were the soup du jour for week 11. Literally in every game, it seemed like someone was getting carried or carted off the field. Chris, what did I just put in front of you?
A chart.
Charts, charts and charts and charts and charts. It's what I live on. I thrive on these.
Do you know what is this, 23 injuries from week 11?
From week 11 and then below it week 10. I charted the significant notable injuries to starting players in the NFL over the last 2 weeks. When you take a look at what happened between last week and this week, 34 notable in-game injuries to AFC teams in just the last 2 weeks. Only four of them were season-ending. Brown, you know, Jan Brown, the linebacker out of Tennessee, which was really unfortunate because it's the same elbow he dislocated right before the playoffs last year. He dislocated it. This time he fractured the socket. My wife saw the play and goes, I don't think he's going to be okay.
I would have puked.
I was like, honey, he's a 255-pound man who tried to support his whole weight on his elbow. No, he's not going to be okay. Jayon Brown, Ravens tight end Nick Boyle, Patriots running back Brian Burkhead, and Joe Burrow, all with last names ending in B's, oddly enough.
Well, what about Burrow's injury?
Oh, God, he's done. What they said, there's no way he'll be in ready in time for week one next year. They've already said that.
No, where did it happen?
I don't know.
It happened in Washington. Where do all horrific knee injuries happen?
Oh, my God. In I didn't even Washington. Think about that. Good Lord.
Alex Smith. Joe Theismann. Joe Burrow.
Those were the only four season-ending injuries. But they all played significant roles for their teams, right?
Yeah.
The AFC North, when you take a look at this, and we'll be tweeting out a screenshot of this over at Rockpile Report on Twitter. So make sure you go over to our Twitter handle, check out this chart, give us a follow. The AFC North seems to be the most impacted by these. I mean, you've got Cleveland, who's now missing, what, they're one of the better defensive ends in all of football in Myles Garrett. And they've lost cornerback one Denzel Ward for at least a couple weeks.
Sure.
Pittsburgh, they lose Juju Smith-Schuster on a Kevin Cobb-esque slip on a plastic mat. Chris, he got Mario Karted.
Yeah, I saw he stepped on a flag.
He stepped on the referee's flag, slipped, and somehow turned his ankle. And now they're talking about him potentially missing Thursday's game against the Ravens. Is that not one of the most ridiculous injuries of the 2020 season?
It is. They should put him on IR, actually.
It was like Mario Kart. He got banana peeled. That's ridiculous. Baltimore, their offense flows through their tight ends and running backs. We know that. So losing Nick Boyle last week was huge, clearly. And then now, coming into Thursday night, a game against divisional opponent, the Pittsburgh Steelers, they lose both of their running backs and one of their best defensive tackles to COVID. How devastating is that?
Not devastating at all. You deserve it.
See, I think I'm the petty one. Yeah. Cheers, sir. I'll drink to that.
Cheers.
No, we're not drinking. Folks, relax. We're not drinking to these players being infected with COVID. We're just...
I am.
Jesus Christ. Chris, I'm trying to sell... Stop it here. No one deserves to get COVID. It's just one of those things. We're not wishing terrible things on people. It's just the Ravens, all the hype and all the talk about how great this team was. These injuries and ineffectiveness are derailing their season. Miami has found itself in a weird place now. When you look at these injuries, Kyle Van Noy, who's struggling to play through a hip injury. Their best running backs are on the shelf. And then this week, Solomon Kinley gets hurt last week with a foot injury. Or illness. We said it at the onset of this season. Miami has talent, but they chose to trust rookies as backups across the offensive line. How's that panning out now? 6 sacks for Tua, he gets benched. New England gets further depleted because they lost a reliable piece of their offense on one that's just desperate for them. Like people crawling through a desert looking for water. That's what New England is looking for. Any kind of consistency on offense. Rex Burkhead was another piece that might have been able to give them that sometimes, and now he's gone too. And I think that the most significant attrition, and the thing that makes this interesting, is that it's occurring to the teams in the thick of the wild card race, not so much the teams at the tops of their respective divisions. The Chiefs, the Steelers, and the Bills. Most of the injuries that we watched happen, I mean, Chris, you look at the list. Just to give our listeners an idea of what we're looking at, what is this chart? Describe it to them.
I'm going to go back to it. I believe you just have a list of all the injuries. What is it, 23 injuries from week 11?
By team, by position, yeah. Player, the type of injury, and whether it was season, whether it was indefinitely, whether it was out for the game.
Yeah, I mean, you sent this to me, and I'm just looking at who's on this list of that Buffalo is playing.
Well, look upcoming. At this.
So, you know, the Steeler injuries, the Charger injuries.
The Chargers lost linebacker Nwosu to a shoulder injury. He's going to miss multiple weeks. Also, as Garrett Sisti talked about in our Rockpile report, Hayward, now he gets pulled from the game with a groin injury. He was already struggling to carry deep with wide receivers. He was struggling to cover. Now he's got a groin injury. I don't know that you can even trust him to play in a game like this against the Bills' wide receivers. It's these middling and lower-level teams that seem to be suffering the worst of it. I mean, what, the Texans lost both their starting, what, number two and number three wide receivers?
Cobb and Stills out.
And then because of the previous week's injuries, they had benched their left tackle and starting left guard, which makes the fact that they beat the Patriots all that more hilarious. But the fact is Chris, it's like we've talked with Reed Ferguson, captain of the Buffalo Bills on this podcast. You get hurt when you're not going 100%.
Mm-hmm.
This might be the one season where there's been the biggest disparity in the haves and have-nots in the AFC. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Between the teams that you know can compete and the teams that clearly are not cut out for this season. So with that in mind, it's not shocking to see that the lower echelon teams are the ones getting all the injuries. And it's gonna muddy the waters for this wild card race. But for the Buffalo Bills, I don't know. Sean McDermott said it at the onset of the season when he was asked about conditioning amid COVID protocols and the reduced time and the way teams had to manage things. He said, whoever handles this the best, both COVID and injury-wise, conditioning-wise, those teams are going to have a significant leg up later in the season. It's playing out that way. And it's advantageous for the Buffalo Bills because right now, short of the Chiefs and the Steelers, we're probably one of the healthiest teams in the entire conference. Hopefully we can keep that up this week against the Chargers. For anybody out there who's still looking for our preview of this week's Chargers versus Buffalo preview, head over to our Rock Pile Report podcast, which aired yesterday. You can check all of our stuff out. We hosted Garrett Sisti from SB Nation's Bolts from the Blue podcast host. It was a good time. It was a good conversation, and it made me feel a little bit better, just a tiny bit better, about our upcoming game. So as we move forward, we're talking about the New York Jets, who lost 34-28 versus the Chargers. And Chris...
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention? I've just been handed an urgent and horrifying news story. And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
The New York Jets have officially been mathematically eliminated from postseason contention. And it only took, what, 11 weeks? It only took 11 weeks. And here to talk to us about it is Mr. Scott Mason. How are you dealing with the fallout of this thing that you didn't see coming? You had no idea that... No.
It's 2020 co-type.
I am so stunned. I honestly thought that there was still hope that they were going to win all the rest of their games, finish, what would that make them, 7-9, and then still not make the playoffs. So I'm really devastated right now, guys.
Well, listen, no, it's funny because so this morning I'm driving into work and I hear Keyshawn Johnson on his ESPN radio show talking about how he heard it in the locker room. Kotite comes in. You know, he's with the Jets. They're one of the worst teams in football. They're 1-7. And Kotite comes in the room and starts clapping his hands going, all right, guys, we're not out of it yet. There's still hope. We could still get back on track. And he goes, I remember looking around the room at some of the other guys going, did he get lost? Does he think he's in the other locker room? Like, does he know what's happening here? So it's just hilarious to see that, like, this is where the Jets are now. You're officially mathematically eliminated from postseason contention. And as I tweeted you about this prior to the show, I want to try to draw some corollaries here. Adam Gase or Rich Kotite? Who was actually worse? Now, when you look at Adam Gase, 20-40 over his last 60 games as a head coach. Chris, that's not good.
Right? No.
33%? It's probably not good. When you look at the total win percentage, Gase is 30-44, 400, what was it, 405, but 0.405. And Kotite was 40-56 at 0.417. But Kotite at least had a playoff win under his belt. Doesn't that, by default, make him a better coach than Adam Gase?
Well, no, because first of all, let's remember who he was coaching when he got that playoff win. Have you seen those Eagles rosters? You had Reggie White, Clyde Simmons, Seth Joyner, Jerome Brown, Randall Cunningham was a quarterback. I mean, those were loaded Eagles rosters. He vastly underachieved with those teams. And then if you want to talk about what he did with the Jets, I mean, my God, I've got stories upon stories on that one, Drew, if you really want to have a chuckle.
I was going to tell you.
I was going to say, what's a good one? What's a good story that you can tell us that I've never heard about Rich Kotite?
Okay, so this one comes directly from Marcus Coleman, who is a cornerback on the team. And he told me that he and Ray Mickens were drafted in the same draft. I believe Ray was drafted in the third, Marcus in the fifth. And to be honest, that was a good draft because those two guys ended up being really good starters for a significant period of time. Ray Mickens was way ahead of his time as a nickel corner, and Marcus Coleman turned out to be a really nice compliment to Aaron Glenn, who, for anybody that doesn't remember, was one of the best cornerbacks of that era. I always joke that Aaron Glenn was Darrell Revis without the flashy nickname. There was no Aaron Glenn Island. But anyway, Marcus was telling me that after they started practicing and doing everything, he was talking to Ray Mickens because they were both rookies, and he looked at him and he said, now Marcus had played at Texas Tech. He said, am I crazy or is this way easier than college? This can't be right, can it? Like, that doesn't feel right. Like, this is the NFL. And Ray Mickens was like, yeah. And that set the tone because Rich Kotite just, I mean, this is a guy that was known to be on the golf course at like 3 p.m. on a Friday, the weekend of a game. Like, this guy just put in no effort. It was an absolute joke. There's a million different stories about what a disaster he is, but here's one from Adrian Morrell, who was actually the star running back for the Jets in 95 and 96, and who has some warm memories of Kotite only because Rich Kotite gave him his first real opportunities as a feature back, but obviously everybody knows what Kotite was as a head coach. So the story was that when Bill Parcells first came in 1997, he took a big, thick trapper keeper and threw it down on the desk. And he said to everybody in the locker room, does anybody know what this is? So somebody said, yeah, coach, that's the playbook. He goes, nope, this is last year's injury report. And this crap stops right now. So think about it. You look at what Neil O'Donnell did in 96. The guy was clearly milking an injury at the end of the season. You could go on and on down the line. The team wasn't prepared. They were mailing it in. And in 96, the reason why I'll say a million times over that Kotite was a way worse coach. Now, we could talk about other aspects of what's going on with the Jets. But in terms of just sheer coach, Rich Kotite won one game in 96 with a playoff caliber roster. The following year, with almost the exact same players, they went 9-7 under Bill Parcells. I'm going to really quickly read you some of the players that were on the 96 Jets, okay? And I know that you may have some younger listeners that don't remember some of these players. But just so you know, this is a much, much better – I mean, it's not even close how much better this roster was compared to what the Jets have right now, okay? Here's Adrian Morrell, their feature back, ran for 1,250 yards that year. Who had three receivers that could arguably be the number one receiver on this Jets team. Wayne Corbett, Keyshawn Johnson, and Jeff Graham. You also had Neil O'Donnell, who, granted, he got hurt at one point, but he was reasonably productive for a few games before getting injured. And certainly you would argue that he was better at that particular point in time than what we've seen from Sam Darnold this year. You look on the defensive side of the ball. By the way, on the offensive line, they had some good players. Supili Malamala, big mountainous tackle. Roger Duffy, pretty good center. And then they had just gone on a spending spree and brought in Jumbo Elliott and David Williams, who were two really good tackles. On the defensive side of the ball, you had Victor Green, who was a longtime mainstay at strong safety, really good player. Marvin Jones, a really good middle linebacker who was a top five pick when he was drafted out of Florida State. He had a really nice year that year as well, one of the leaders of the defense. Marvin Washington, a good defensive lineman on the interior. I already talked about Aaron Glenn, who was one of the best cornerbacks in the league. Ray Mickens and Marcus Coleman, two very talented cornerbacks. Hugh Douglas, who you remember as a multi-time All-Pro with the Philadelphia Eagles. Another really good player, Mo Lewis, a three-time Pro Bowler. Now, to be fair, Mo got hurt halfway through the season, but still, look at all the people that I'm listing. That roster was a really talented roster that improved eight games from one year to the next. That, to me, is what will always seal Rich Kotite's fate as the worst coach in the history of the franchise. And he's right there in the discussion. I think it's probably either him or Hugh Jackson as worst coach of all time. Adam Gase has taken a team that probably should win four games, and they may win zero or one. Rich Kotite took a playoff team and coached it to one win.
Let's not remember 94 with the Eagles. Started 7-2. Missed the playoffs at 7-9.
Listen, well, don't act like that's any different than the Bills starting at 5-2 and going 6-10. Let's not act like we're that.
Well, the funny thing about that one, though, guys, if I can interject really quickly, is that the thing that happened there was the Jets had fired Bruce Coslett, who was their head coach from 1990 to 1993, and they hired his defensive coordinator. They promoted him the head coach. That gentleman you may be familiar with, his name is Pete Carroll. And Carroll, at the time, his first year, everybody was talking about what a good young coach he was, very enthusiastic. The players really loved playing for him. They were 6-5 when Miami came into town. They were winning 24-6, and they were on the verge of taking over first place in the AFC East. And then a fake spike happened. And from there, the Jets lost all the rest of their games, finished 6-10. The owner, Leon Hess, came out and in a now infamous press conference said, "I'm 83 years old. I'm tired of waiting. I want to win now." He fired Carroll after 1 year and hired Kotite, who, as you just pointed out, Chris, certainly a proven winner who had just lost his last 7 games. So he fired a coach that lost his last 5 to hire a coach that lost his last 7. It was remarkable.
And guess how many Super Bowls that coach has now? He has one. He has one. Oh, my God, that's horrible.
He's been to more Super Bowls with the Seahawks than the Jets have been in their entire franchise history.
See, now, what you've made it, for me as a host, you've made it incredibly hard for me to continue putting the boots to you, because I feel like you just walked me through a lifetime of Jets fan suffering. And yet, here we go. Let's talk about Sunday. Has this team finally just quit? I mean, here was my Sunday. I'm downstairs in my basement. Now, my basement is set up to entertain probably what, Chris, between 10 and 15 people?
I would go with more of 2 to 4.
2 to 4. Yeah, depending on how demonstrative I want to be in the middle of a game. I wave my arms. I stalk around.
You need your space. You know, like walk-in in SNL? Gene, really more cowbell. Really explore the studio space.
Yeah.
You need your space to yell and make an ass out of yourself.
So with that in mind, I have 2 wall-mounted flat screens, 255 inches. I've got my tablet going. It's a Sunday with no Bills football. So I'm watching 3 different games at the same time, and I'm loving life. And I go upstairs to take a piss, and I end up just kind of, I see my kid, we're hanging out, I'm rolling around on the floor with him for a little while. I've got the Dolphins game on my upstairs TV. And I come back downstairs to this room, and I see that in just 20 minutes of action, your team is now losing 21-6. You hemorrhaged 21 points in 20 minutes. That almost, Chris, that's difficult to do. A point per minute in a football game? How did you end up in that big of a deficit that quickly?
Well, it's just one of those things. Well, for example, the Jets were able to get a turnover inside their own 5. The Chargers fumbled, right? And then on the very next play, Flacco threw a pick 6. It was one of the laziest throws you could ever imagine. It was the kind of thing you'd expect from Nathan Peterman or somebody like that, not Joe Flacco, who has all this experience.
Of course you invoked that name. God damn.
I had to throw that one in there. But, yeah, and then from there, the thing is, and I was talking to Michael Nania about this earlier today, when you look at Justin Herbert, and I'll be the first one to admit, I never in a million years thought he was going to be this good. I watched him in Oregon quite a bit, and I just thought he hesitated too much. Sometimes he locked his eyes. He didn't process that well. Well, whatever it was he was having trouble with at Oregon, he figured out real quick, because this dude honestly, and look, we'll see how this goes because it's only been about half a season for him, but he looks like a mobile version of Dan Marino, which is beyond scary. I mean, some of these throws this guy makes, I mean, one of them, which you're talking about with the 21 points, he scrambled to his left and across his body threw an absolute bullet into perfect coverage, by the way, between 2 defenders right into Keenan Allen's chest. Couldn't have walked it over there better. And it was just remarkable to watch. And the crazy thing about Herbert, and I mentioned Marino, he looks to be the best rookie quarterback we've seen since Marino. And there have been some pretty impressive rookie campaigns, but this is just incredible. I mean, he's shredding what Andrew Luck did 8 years ago. So really, to answer your question, what happened was Joe Flacco and Justin Herbert is what happened.
Are you trying to make me feel bad ahead of our game against them? Like, are you? Is that what you're trying? Are you trying to hurt my feelings? Because if, damn it, I mean, oh God, I don't feel good about this football game. I've said it. I just, the Chargers have our number historically. They've had it for the last decade. I've suffered a lot of that. When I watched the game, though, what I found incredibly interesting was I went away from, like most of America did, immediately turned off the Jets game and went to something more competitive. And then when I came back to look at the final box score, I said, wait a minute, this team came back. They came back. They scored points. And in talking to our guest in our Rock Pile Report podcast, Garrett Sisti, he was talking about that to a bit. And he said that that's kind of the Achilles heel of that Chargers team, is that Herbert is amazing, but that their rushing attack is so stagnant and it's so bad, and their offensive line is so just unable to dictate play to the opposing defense that but their coach is stubbornly old school. So he thinks he can salt away a big lead by running the ball in the second half, and it never pans out for them. They've lost more games after leading than any team this year. You guys mounted a comeback. Now, Denzel Mims, it seems like he had a pretty solid day. Who stood out to you in that comeback effort that you're looking to the future saying, those are our guys?
Well, I'll tell you, Mims would be one of them, certainly, because what happened in the first half was that not one single receiver had a catch the entire first half. And they just ran the ball, ran the ball, ran the ball. And then in the second half, it was like they came out and said, you know what, maybe we should try throwing the ball downfield to some of these receivers. And there was one drive where Denzel Mims caught like three passes for first downs and drew three pass interference penalties. So he was just dialed in. He was tremendous. And he looks like a guy that, barring injury, knock on wood, could be a real keeper for this team. Rashad Perriman is another one. Listen, the injuries have always been a problem for him, and he's been maddeningly inconsistent. Boy, I can talk today. But when he gets open downfield, he's got burner speed. So he was breaking free and getting opportunities there. And then Mekhi Becton. I mean, listen, what else can you say about this kid? He went up against Joey Bosa and Melvin Ingram all day, allowed zero pressures, was just as dominant as you could be in pass protection. And then on the other side of the ball, it was all the interior defensive line. Foley Fadakasi's turned into one of the best interior run stuffers in the league. He's just outstanding. John Franklin Myers has been an incredible surprise. He's been a tremendous pass rusher on the interior. And then the guy that really is making the difference is Quinnen Williams. He came back from injury. He had a run for a loss. He had a fumble recovery and seven pressures. So those are the guys that you really look at and say, you know, here are some pieces that the Jets have that can really help out down in the long term. In addition to Jamison Crowder, who was open a few times, but Flacco didn't see him. So there are guys there. It's just going to be a matter of, in the offseason, the Jets have a lot of money and a lot of draft picks. Got to use them wisely. I mean, we've said that many times in the past, and I'm sure you guys can commiserate because that's been the case with the Bills in the past as well. If you hit, you hit, and the team is in the right direction. If you don't, well, then you're headed right back to this same conversation in a couple of years.
Here's a question. When you look at, you guys are obviously on the campaign for the first draft pick. You want that top pick. Is there any fear watching the way they played in that second half and seeing like, hey, when we want to be, we're a competent football team. And clearly you have some guys, some young kids with some fire. Sam Darnold returning to the lineup, probably wanting to rehab some of his image. How worried are Jets fans that Jacksonville's there? They're right on your heels for that first draft pick. And I think that by nature of their losses, I mean, now you're talking about tiebreakers for the number one pick in the draft. Is there any concern in Jets Nation that, oh my God, is it, that you guys could potentially have this nightmare season and not end up with the first pick?
Oh, yeah, everybody's terrified. Everybody's terrified. Because like you said, the Jaguars are right there. I think if the Jaguars weren't there, people wouldn't be as scared because you would think, well, it would take three wins. And a lot of people would look at the rest of the schedule and say, while it's theoretically possible, the odds of the Jets winning three of their last six are not very good. But the odds of them winning one game, those odds are very reasonable. And listen, that doesn't mean that the Jaguars won't win another game, but they very well could go 1-15. And then you're putting it in the hands of the tiebreaker. You don't know what's going to happen. Plus, also, as I pointed out, and Michael Nanny tweeted out today, having the first overall pick outright without having to use a tiebreaker gives you another advantage that people don't talk about, which is that you get the first pick in every single round, which is especially important in rounds 2 and 4, which you wouldn't get if you tie for the pick, because then you would get the number one pick, but then it would alternate rounds and you wouldn't get 2 and 4. 2 and 4 are important because, as you know, day one ends after the first round. So all the teams sit around and go, oh, who do we miss? Who do we miss? All of a sudden, that first pick on day two becomes super valuable. Same thing with the first pick on day three, the first pick in the fourth round. So there's so much riding on this in terms of the Jets' future. And, yeah, fans are absolutely terrified. I mean, I can't even tell you. We didn't talk last week, but I had friends of mine texting me that they were practically crapping their pants during that Patriots game. And I had another friend who is not from America. He's from Northern Ireland. And when he moved to New York, he became a Jets fan, let's say 15 years ago or whatever, 10, 15 years ago. And he's calling me, telling me how he's going to burn all his Jets jerseys. And he's so tired of this. And the Jets can't even lose right. And he's had enough. And he's not from New York. So what does he care and all this? People are very, very scared about this. And they have good reason to be scared because, look, we've seen it with Sam Darnold. You guys have watched it. All it takes is for him to get hot for a game or two, and that's it. That could be all she wrote. So that is something that we're all very, very scared about. And I'll be honest, I mean, I told somebody this earlier in the week, but I absolutely believe it. The only game this season where I went in not scared that the Jets might pull something off was that Chiefs game. That was the only one where I was like, you know what? It's not going to matter because the Chiefs can score 8,000 points. I'm not worried about that. Every other game, I'm like, well, I don't think they're going to win, but you never know. Something crazy could happen. I mean, look what happened in that second Bills game. The Bills should have won by a million points. And they didn't, and the Jets hung around. It was absolutely possible. And look, this Chargers game, with 3 minutes left in the game, they had the opportunity to drive for what could have been the game-tying touchdown. So every week, we're all going to be very nervous about this for the rest of the season.
Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you on social and what's coming up over there at Play Like a Jet?
So you can find me at Play Like a Jet 1, and then the show is available on all platforms that you would normally get your podcast. So Apple, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, all that. And then we do 7 days a week of Jets content. So Monday, and the show goes up just after midnight every day. So if you're somebody that works a graveyard shift, or you're somebody that gets up really early in the morning, it'll be there for you whenever you want it. On Mondays, it's the post-game report with Andy Vasquez of NorthJersey.com. We go through everything that went down in the game, head into the locker room, get all the quotes, the injury updates, the news, all that. On Tuesdays, there's always Next Year with Brian Bassin and his friends Travis Milton and Josh Conrad. They do sort of a Jets variety show where they talk Jets, throw in some comedy, pop culture stuff. It's pretty funny, and it's a nice change of pace. On Wednesdays, we do the midweek news with Manish Mehta of the New York Daily News. Thursdays, it's draft talk now because, as you know, Drew, you were the last person on the Know Your Foe segment because no one cares anymore about the opponent.
You're all checked out.
Drew was the cleanup hitter there. So
yes!
We're doing draft talk. Every other week, we're alternating between Connor Rogers of Bleacher Report and Charlie Campbell of WalterFootball.com. Stock reports every week. And then Fridays, we take a look at the advanced analytics with Michael Nanny of Jets X Factor. Saturdays, your old buddy Joe Blewett comes on to talk film. And then on Sundays, we do the pregame report and mailbag with Chris Nibley of JetsInsider.com. And we give you your gambling tips with Walter Cherpinski of WalterFootball.com. So full lineup every week. Appreciate you guys having me on. As always, love talking to you guys. And as I always like to say, I'm always happy to come on the Rockpile Reports AFC East Roundup Show and take my beating like a 1980s WWF jobber.
Thanks to a lack of natural athleticism or commitment or overbearing sports parents, fewer than 1% of 1% of 1% of people will ever play professional football. But instead of entering the NFL, they've joined another league, the League of Football Watchers. This football season will be different, and Pepsi is here to get you ready for game day no matter how you watch. Like this Sunday, from Drew's in Cheektowaga, we'll be watching Bills and Chargers. And thanks to Kyle Trimble of Banged Up Bills, Drew has his own stress bench. That's right, a wicker bench for when he gets stressed out about Brian Daboll in the third quarter. But Pepsi is the refreshment you need to power through any game day, because Pepsi isn't made for those who play the game. It's made for those who watch it. Pepsi, made for football watching.
Of that, we bring in our Patriots expert extraordinaire, Mike DeBate from Locked On Patriots. How are you doing tonight, sir?
From that introduction, I'm guessing that you want to get a rest in peace. am I right or am I wrong, fellas? I'm guessing that. I'm sensing it. But
my question is this. Would you agree with the rest of us over here in Bills Mafia that despite some signs of life, maybe some flickers, that you and I have just witnessed the passing of the 2020 New England Patriots postseason hopes?
I would say on slim life support, gentlemen. Slim life support. I think that in a lot of ways, the Patriots' playoff ceiling now is 2021. And you know, I wouldn't have said that prior to Sunday's game against the Texans, but now, having fallen to 4-6, looking at the teams in the AFC and how the situation is shaping up, it's going to be a hard sell. It's going to be a really, really hard sell for this team to catch fire, be able to beat some of the teams they have on the schedule, including Sunday's opponent, the Arizona Cardinals, including the games coming up against Miami, against Buffalo, most definitely. The two LA teams are playing very well right now, the Rams more so, but the Chargers definitely have an explosive young quarterback in Justin Herbert. The Jets, well, they're the Jets, but the rest of those games in a lot of ways pose a great deal of threat to the New England Patriots. So while technically they're still alive, it's not looking good for the Patriots playoffs hopes. And this might finally be the year that you see a postseason without the flying Elvis on the side of a silver helmet.
I mean, you guys have a difficult stretch of games. Four teams that have six or more wins, which are two better than you. You guys lack a tiebreaker with Buffalo or Kansas City. And given AFC performances, which, I mean, when you look at what the, right now, the six win teams, the Miami Dolphins, the Raiders, I mean, you've beaten two of them, which is odd considering where they are and where you guys are, that you've beaten two of those teams and then the Baltimore Ravens, in fact, three of them. You guys have beaten all of the teams in the wild card hunt, and yet you yourselves find yourselves two games back from that. It's just, it's hard to believe that despite beating all of those teams, seven losses, it just might be too much to qualify. You guys are on the doorstep here, and you're facing an opponent with an explosive offense that could very much be the Achilles heel. I mean, I'm incredibly interested about this game coming up on Sunday because it's going to be kind of your, it's like Custer's last stand. This is going to be your Waterloo. It's where you guys are going to live and die. When we look back at the past weekend, what happened to you guys in the trenches in this game? I mean, zero sacks. I was working in and out of the garage, and I had the tablet out, and for some reason I couldn't turn away from your game. And I'm listening to it as I'm working outside, and then I'm working in the garage, and I'm back outside with the siding and monkeying around with things. And as I'm listening to it, I'm like, why do the Patriots not sound like they're engaged in this game at all?
Well, I think in a lot of ways what the Texans did was prove exactly what you need to do to beat the New England Patriots, and that is attack the middle of the field coverage, throwing off leverage against man coverage and manipulating the second level zone defenders. The Patriots just did not have an answer for that on Sunday. They couldn't defend the middle of the field, and it's a pick your poison at that point. You either let some of the Patriots' young athletic players make mistakes, which we've seen them do. Kyle Duggar had a rough game coming off of a very good game against the Baltimore Ravens, in which the Ravens did not attack the middle of the field. I was a little surprised they didn't do that, but the Houston Texans did that very well, and Deshaun Watson does that as well as any quarterback in the league. So you either let your young athletic players make those mistakes, or you live with some of the slow-footed veterans in coverage like Juwan Bentley, who really struggled on Sunday. Chase Winovich had an up-and-down game. John Simon looked a little bit slower. The coverage between the numbers has been a significant issue for this defense all season long, and that's one of the big reasons why I think the Patriots look so much engagement, like you said, in this one. Just defensively, they just seem to have no answer for what Deshaun Watson was doing. He played very well, there's no question about it, and I'm certainly not trying to lessen the impact he had on this game, but it's almost like the Patriots made him look a little bit better than he really played. Watson finished the game completing 75% of his passes, threw for 344 yards, two touchdowns. The receivers were able to create separation. Jordan Akins, a tight end that not a lot of people game plan for, had five catches for 83 yards. He had plenty of success. It seemed like whether it was Kyle Duggar or John Jones or Juwan Williams, they had problems defending the tight ends. The Texans did not run the ball all that well. The Patriots really stuffed the box, did a good job of keeping the Texans from running the football. And they made them one-dimensional. The problem is that dimension, named Deshaun Watson, the Patriots had no answer for. If Kyler Murray and the vaunted Arizona Cardinals offense comes into Gillette Stadium and does a lot of what Deshaun Watson and the Texans did to them, it's going to be a very, very long afternoon for the Patriots in Foxborough.
I think one of the more damning things about the pass rush was that you're talking about a Houston team that sat its priority free agent, trade target, highly paid left tackle, and left guard. Most, they were both on the bench. And you guys still managed zero sacks on the day. Which is...
Yeah, without...
I mean, well,
absolutely, yeah.
No, I guess that's my question is, the pass rush really that bad, or did they do something special to stymie you guys? Because that just seems absurd.
Well, in a lot of ways, I think it was. It was a lack of the commitment to the pass rush. I was a little surprised at Chase Winovich and Dietrich Wise not being able to capitalize on the left side of the offensive line. You mentioned Laremy Tunsil, and you know, without him in the lineup, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that the Patriots should have more success getting after Deshaun Watson. They should have been able to manipulate that matchup. They didn't. They did not generate pressure on the quarterback. Chase did to a certain extent, but he ended up out of position as he tried to finish off his plays. Watson was able to extend the play, found receivers downfield, and when that happens and you have a guy that's trying to overextend himself, trying to get to the quarterback and trying to apply pressure that really isn't there, a good quarterback like Deshaun Watson's going to pick you apart, and that's exactly what happened. The other part is the linebackers just simply did not have enough in that crew to be able to match any type of speed, any type of consistency with Watson and some of his skill position players. A lot of what happened on Sunday really results from someone like Juwan Bentley, who just simply does not have the speed or the savvy that a guy like Dont'a Hightower had. And when you look at the struggles that these guys have had, it's really not a big mystery as to why the Patriots have struggled. The Texans exploited it to the best of their ability on Sunday and really showed some of the deficiencies in this Patriots team, how to slow their pass rush and how to take them out of the game. That's the blueprint now. And unfortunately, the team that's coming in does the Houston Texans as well, if not better, than they do themselves. And that's the Arizona Cardinals.
On the opposite side of the football, your offensive line wasn't much better. I mean, Damian Harris still had a touchdown. He did his thing. But Damian Harris is, am I wrong? Is he your running back one now?
Yeah, without question. Okay. Without question at all, Damian Harris is definitely the workhorse on this team.
So Sonny Michel, the first-round draft pick, he's kind of a...
He's Lawrence Maroney'd himself.
Yeah, I don't know if necessarily Sony has dropped to that level yet, but at the same time, look, there's no question about it. Harris hits the holes, he hits the seams much better than Sony did. He just runs with more of a confidence, he runs with a lot more conviction, he's able to find the lanes, and he's able to extend plays and get yards after from the line of scrimmage. That's something Sony hasn't been able to be consistent with. He's had moments and flashes where he looks like that running back out of Georgia that Bill Belichick probably saw, coveted, wanted, and drafted, but Harris is doing a much, much better job, and he's also much better at being able to catch and move out of the backfield with the ball as well. So,
well, that, you know why that is?
Versatility.
You know why that is, right? Rule time! Woo! That's what I'm talking about! Running back university, my ass. Georgia can get bent. Your offensive line, though, 3.6 yards per carry with a running back stable like yours, even with a heavy rush load, 24 carries, just 86 total yards, it just seemed like they got no push. And so now you're struggling on both sides of the line. There's no way that this team, with knowing that their passing game is anemic at best, there's no way that team can survive. So you're looking at the one strength you guys had left, which was your secondary, and instead, without a Randall Cobbs, without a Kenny Stills, who both left the game with leg injuries, you saw a vintage Watson performance. 9 different players with 2 receptions? That's crazy to me. How did their approach test your secondary? Like, where did you guys have the breakdowns back there?
Well, there were breakdowns in coverage all over the place. And look, I think the secondary definitely, you know, struggled a lot more than most thought they would. But I think a lot of it came from just in the inability for the Patriots to get any type of pressure, any type of containment on Watson. When Watson has the ability to choose his targets and he has the ability to hit his targets, he's going to. J.C. Jackson struggled in coverage. Stephon Gilmore had a decent game coming back from an injury, but at the same time, he wasn't the same type of disruptive force that everyone had hoped that he'd be coming back into the lineup and injecting a little bit into that lineup. The breakdowns in coverage with the linebackers caused problems as well. You saw it when the touchdown run that Deshaun Watson had toward the end of the first half. Juwan Bentley had a terrible read on that, was basically grabbing at his ankles, no way that he was going to be able to stop him. It allowed Watson to get the one-on-one matchup against Devin McCourty, and Devin usually doesn't struggle in these types of games, but he was absolutely just mauled over by Watson on the way to the end zone. These types of breakdowns in coverage can really be a problem. So it wasn't so much in one-on-one type coverage, it was really a breakdown of the scheme. Credit the Houston Texans, they did a lot to be able to do it, but Patriots need to do a much better job on the defensive line, the interior of the defensive line, stop up front, and be able to have the versatility in the linebacking crew to allow the secondary to play their game. The Patriots just simply did not have that on Sunday.
So we're left with 2 big questions. The first one, this is, Chris, I can already see you smiling. We all thought, we talked about, in the run-up to this game, we talked about how when the schedule makers came up with this, they said it was going to be student versus master. It's going to be an interesting game. It's going to get a lot of pull, which is why it's going to be on, it's going to be a nationally televised game. It's going to be big. And then both teams shriveled and they kind of shrank those plans. And instead you got Romeo Crennel, also of the Belichick tree. Out of all the coaches that have ever beaten Belichick, is Romeo Crennel the one you expected to do it?
Honestly, there's a part of me that did. And, you know, Romeo has been well regarded up here in New England for quite some time. He was the architect, along with Bill, of those early defenses that the Patriots built in the early days of their dynasty. Romeo Crennel doesn't necessarily have the national cachet, but believe me when I tell you, he's got a lot of respect up here in this area. And I thought his game planning on Sunday was very sound. The Texans were determined to take away the Patriots' run. That's their strength. They played a 4-man line. They didn't play their typical 3-4 run defense that everyone was expecting. And a lot of people, myself included, thought the Patriots would just run roughshod over. They smartly inserted an 8th run defender into the box, forcing the Patriots to throw. That's not their style. That's not their strength. And that meant
pressure on Cam Newton. All of a sudden, you're seeing Houston blitz Cam on 17 of his 42 dropbacks. Cam only averaged 4.6 yards per attempt while taking two sacks against the blitz. One of the problems that you're seeing with Cam right now, and it's because of some deficiencies in the offensive line blocking, especially on Sunday, but some of it's going to be on his shoulders as well, is Cam's ability to pre-snap recognize the blitz. Either he doesn't have the control or he's failing to sense pressures. And that was made a lot worse by the offensive line play on Sunday. But if you find a defensive coordinator or a defensive-minded head coach that's willing to do this against the Patriots, it's their kryptonite. And give a lot of credit to Romeo Crennel. He had a good game plan, came in, saw it, and he attacked it, and that's exactly what happened on Sunday. One of the reasons why the Patriots look so futile.
It's crazy to me how guys like Matt Patricia can occasionally beat, like, these subpar coaches can occasionally beat Belichick, and yet no Patriots fan ever bats an eye at it. They say, okay, well, that's one loss. Bill doesn't care. We're moving on. We're on to the next game. You lose. We're on to Cincinnati. Every time you guys have a bad loss, it's, well, listen, we've always rebounded. There's always been this bigger and brighter future ahead of us, so we don't care about this one pothole we ran into. This season, there is no bigger and brighter. In fact, if anything, right now, the light at the end of the tunnel is getting dimmer and dimmer. So with that in mind, how is the Patriots fan base taking the fact that you've now lost to a washed up Belichick disciple, and that your season has come this far from where the people on ESPN were gassing everybody up, talking about how you guys were dark horses for the Super Bowl just because you had Cam Newton? How is the Patriots fan base? What's the temperature over there?
Fever pitch. And I would say that in a lot of ways where I'd say that in a negative sense, not in a positive sense, of course. Let me clarify. The fan base is not, as a whole, is not taking it well. I mean, you've got fans that are absolutely just steadfast, and they're diehards, and they'll live and die with the team. You've got casuals that are kind of starting to hop off the bandwagon now. We knew that was going to happen. There's no question about it. But what surprises me the most is the large sect of the fan base that seems very content to just be rooting against this team in a lot of ways. And that really surprises me after everything that this team has provided this fan base for the last 20 years, that you have so many people that are sort of relishing in their struggles. Now, I don't know if it's loyalty to Tom. I don't know if it's just getting on Bill or not being able to handle losses. So treating it like it's a joke and acting like it's funny is a little bit surprising. It's just a little bit perplexing to me. You know, you look at some of the fan bases, stark raving fan bases that have known nothing but misery in a lot of ways. You know, you look at a team like Cleveland that hasn't had a lot of things to celebrate, but yet their fans are very positive and they always remain positive. You know, not to throw a salvo in your direction, but Buffalo hasn't had a whole lot of great moments in the last 20 years, but that's one of the most dedicated, one of the most steadfast fan bases you'll find, and they will live and die with that team. They'll go to the wall for it, and that's something I've always respected about the Buffalo fan base. In New England right now, you're seeing who's the fans and who's not. But ultimately, I think you'll find a lot of the fans are starting to realize that this team's ceiling is more for 2021 than it is 2020. Build for the future. There's still a lot of in Bill we trust, but a lot of it's media driven here as well. There's a lot of cracks in the foundation when it comes to the Belichick armor. A lot of people are starting to attack that, and it's permeating into the fan base. But ultimately, it is what it is. You know, the team will continue to move forward. I will say this, the large part of the fan base that I've seen seems to be behind Cam Newton, and I'm happy to see that because I think Cam has come in and done the best job he possibly can, and I would like to see him get another shot at being able to lead this team, maybe with some additional weapons and maybe with a little bit more continuity than they had in terms of some of the opt-outs with COVID, some of the difficulties this team has had.
You were very polite in sending in talking about us. Chris, you can say, I've been one of those people. The manic Bills fans. He's talking about how Bills fans, he was talking about, oh, the Bills fans are always supportive of their team. How many times do I root for some? How many times do I call for someone's head during a game?
100%.
No, but what's the under over? 5-6? Do you think it's fair? If I called it the under, you'd take the over?
Yes, every time.
And that's during every game.
Well,
Mike, that's during every game.
Well, there's a difference between being critical for the sake of being critical and then being critical of the team because of the passion that you have. That's something that's completely different. And believe me, there's a lot of Patriots fans that are critical of Belichick and the coaching staff and the game planning and the players on the field because they're passionate about the team. A lot of what I'm referring to is sort of that fair weather type of chameleon fan that's not really dedicated or really, you know, entrenched in wanting to see the team do well. They're just upset because they can't, you know, hear, you know, Your Love by the Outfield and you know, in Gillette Stadium, or they're a little upset because they can't wear the Patriots hat, or they can't, you know, go out and have a Super Bowl party every single year. It's more about what the team's success does for them and their social life than what the team's actually doing. And I think you're seeing some of those kind of fall off in New England a little bit. Whereas I think in Buffalo, I think just the stark raving passion, that type of dedication to criticize a team or whatever when they're not playing well, it is something that that I think has been there in Buffalo. That's what I've always respected about that fan base.
Chris, how do we not love this guy? I mean, look at it.
It's hard. Hard.
Mike, you're the best. Why don't you tell everybody what you have going over at Locked On this week and where they can find you on social and where they can find your show?
So, sure, you can find me on the Bird app, as my good friend Mark Schofield says, at MDABATEFPC. Speaking of my good buddy Sko, he's actually going to be my guest tomorrow on Locked On Patriots. We're going to go over a little dichotomy in terms of what to expect from Kyler Murray, what to expect from Cam Newton coming up this weekend. And then, of course, Thursday, we're taking the day off celebrating Thanksgiving. But Friday, we'll be back at it. Crossover Friday this week. Between myself and Clancy, the host of Locked On Cardinals, we'll be getting you ready for Sunday's game. And, of course, you can always find us anywhere you get your podcasts, Locked On Patriots podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts. Wherever you find your podcasts, we're available.
Al Fartiaga, Scott Mason, and Mike DeBate, just three of the best guys that cover their respective teams. They're almost like Demolition from 1990, WWF.
I love that you know all these crappy wrestlers. Yeah.
Well, Demolition was some of the best tag team wrestling in the late 80s. Axe, Smash, and then Crush came
Think
in.
Think about what you just said.
Yeah.
Best tag team wrestling of the 1980s.
Late 80s. That's what we just had. We basically just had Demolition of podcasting on.
If there's anything out there that I can give to you, the listener, that man who just spoke has a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And she's cute, and she's nice, and she cooks. She baked me something tonight.
Not you, us.
Us. But God. Me. Let's.
Yeah, well, I already text her that you were just like eating it out of the bag that I put for your wife because she said, give some to Larissa.
So yeah, I will wolf that down without even sharing it.
I conveniently put some in a Ziploc bag for her. And
my point is, guys, take away from this that man who sits here like a dork talking about 1980s wrestling has a gorgeous girlfriend. You have it too. No matter what you have going on in your life, no matter what's wrong, no matter what your malfunction might be, you too can achieve the mountaintop if you try hard enough. Chris has certainly outkicked his coverage, and so have I.
You way worse than me.
Looking towards week 12, here's the week 12 outlook as I see the AFCs laying out. You've got Buffalo home against the Chargers. Last 1 p.m. game for what could be the rest of the season, depending on whether or not the Dolphins can make the AFC's title race interesting come week 17. Chris, am I not a genius for investing in the Sunday ticket this year?
Yeah, we're good, so we got a lot of primetime games. So
I get a lot of Sundays where I can watch whatever the hell I want. You guys should have taken advantage of our Blue Wire offer earlier in the season.
Yeah.
Oh, the Bills need to start the back end of the schedule on the right foot, and getting a win here against a 3-win Chargers team would be the easiest way to do that, right?
Yeah.
Am I crazy? No. Well, yes, but no. Miami Dolphins, away against the New York Jets. Tua is still the starter. And it's going to be interesting to see not if, but by how much Tua rebounds from his benching against a team that, outside of the young guys, are pretty much just biding their time until they can pack it in for the winter, fly to Florida, and play golf. Is that a fair assessment of things?
Correct.
Is there any chance in your mind that they lose this game?
No chance.
You've got New England away against the Cardinals on the brink of postseason elimination with their odds now in the single digits. The offensively challenged and suddenly defensively porous Patriots are now going to be taking on a Cardinals team that can score with anyone. They can hold serve with any of the NFL's strongest offenses. So against New England? I mean, the only hope for the Patriots is that they can run the ball, control the clock, and maybe that gives them a shot. Maybe. I mean, if not, and if the ball bounces just the right ways around the rest of the conference, you and I, Chris, could be celebrating the actual demise of the New England Patriots in 2020.
That sounds amazing.
And then you get the New York Jets, which, honestly, who cares? I mean, these guys could be going to Pennsylvania to play the Temple Owls, and I still wouldn't love them against the spread. That's how bad this has gotten. Oh, it's another week of an interesting AFC East. I can't wait for it. I'm ready. Chris, thank you to all of our guests. Thank you to you for putting up with all my lunacy and my badgering of your terrible taste.
Hey, that's what I'm here for.
Folks, and thank you to all of you who show up each and every week. I don't know why, but we love you just the same. But it's time to get out of here. I'm Drew Geer. Our guests were amazing. That's Chris Krueger, and this has been your AFC East Roundup.
Football is back in full swing. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on every possible chance to win this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than anywhere else. You can get in on their season opening bonuses today and start off wagering on wins, division, and championship futures all day, every day. Head to BetOnline today and take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. Don't forget to use the promo code BLUEWIRE at BetOnline.ag. That's BLUEWIRE, all one word. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.